This is WHCL FM, Clinton, New York. I'm Viva Horowitz. Welcome to the show, Significant Figures. I'm here today with my guest, Ryan Martini. Ryan, welcome onto Significant Figures.
Thank you, Viva. It's great to be here. So, I will just say, before we get into it, I enjoy the name of the show quite a lot.
Oh, yeah. Well, chemists and physicists have this in common, right?
Right.
So, like, for those of you who don't know, this is a pun because, of course, today my significant figure is Ryan. He's the person who's a significant person. He's a figure. But it's also a pun because it's a way of counting how many digits are important, the significant figures in a number, as a way to very quickly express the uncertainty that we have in any measurement.
Right, right. Though today's episode or installment might better be called Insignificant Figures, since I don't think I'm of much consequence.
Oh, wow. Okay, or, well.
Perhaps one significant figure and one insignificant figure.
Don't sell yourself short. But you are a biochemist, right?
Correct. Correct.
So a bit of biology, a bit of chemistry. Mm-hmm. And I know I've been lucky enough to even be in the biochemistry research lab here at the chemistry department of Hamilton College. Tell me, how did you get into your area of research?
Absolutely, absolutely. The first thing I'll just mention is that it's a little bit strange. The intersection of biology and chemistry is obviously a fairly expansive area of knowledge. And for better or worse, many different terms have been used for this intersection of fields, from biochemistry, molecular biology, chemical biology, and several others. And they all sort of...
Do they mean the same thing?
Well, depending on who's using them, The answer can be yes or no. As a rule, they do mean slightly different things. So molecular biology tends to be a little bit more on the bio side of the biology and chemistry interface, and often has a lot to do with genetics.
Mm.
And biochemistry, or particularly biological chemistry, is a little bit more on the chemistry side. Chemical biology is a strange sort of other thing that specifically refers to the use of chemical techniques and usually chemical synthesis to design probes and that sort of thing to answer biological questions, but isn't so much the broad intersection of these two fields. It's sort of a more specific thing, which is awfully confusing in my opinion, but here we are.
Okay.
So that didn't really answer your question at all.
No, I honestly love adjectives and nouns and how you can mix and match them.
So I got into biochemistry because I was an undergraduate and I was really interested in the sciences and thought, you know, maybe I'll double major in a couple of things in the sciences. And in high school, I really loved biology. I thought living things are fascinating. This is cool. And I really loved physics. And so I thought maybe biology and physics are the magical combo. And so I started perusing the catalog. This was a physical copy of the catalog that they mailed you because I'm a dinosaur.
Oh, I remember that. But, I'm also that old.
So I'm perusing the catalog and I get to the section of the physics handbook and I saw how many math cognates there were and I was like, close the book. That's it for physics for Ryan.
Okay.
Because I did okay at math in high school, but I've never really enjoyed math a whole lot.
It's a good idea to pick a major where the courses you have to take are ones that you want to take.
Right, right, exactly. And so what I realized is that I was interested in sort of the most detailed view of the world. I wanted to understand things sort of all the way down. That was what got me really excited. But I didn't want to go so far that the answer was an equation. I wanted the answer to be a picture or a principle or a description of some kind. And this is sort of what I see as the philosophical dividing line between chemists and physicists, where in physics, sort of in some ways, the most satisfying answer to a question is a really beautiful equation. And that can sort of be the most satisfying form of knowledge is an equation.
Yeah,
and
it takes some time to get to know an equation and make friends with it.
I have yet to make very many friends with equations, so I'll take your word for it. So anyway, I realized that I wanted that really detailed view of the world, but I wasn't too interested in the most mathematical forms of those answers. And so as a result, I became a chemist, which is sort of exactly what that is. And so in terms of what I consider myself, I consider myself a chemist in terms of my I identify as a chemist. But that being said, I'm interested in biological questions and biological problems because I think that as chemical systems go, there's nothing more complicated and therefore more interesting than living things.
Absolutely.
So that's how I became interested in biological chemistry.
So you majored in biochemistry, and then presumably at some point, you went to grad school.
For better or worse, I did.
Well, it's led you here. So where did you study grad school, and what did you study? What were you researching?
Right. So I went to graduate school at Pennsylvania State University, just a few hours south of here. Mm. And I started studying bioinorganic chemistry is sort of the area that I was working in, and when a lot of people hear that term,
it does sound contradictory.
It sounds like a contradiction in terms, and that's because in the general cultural milieu, organic refers to living things, and inorganic then sounds like it's referring to non-living things. But in chemistry, we use the term organic to refer to the type of chemistry surrounding carbon-based molecules. And so this includes a lot of living, you know, most living things. We're carbon-based life forms, right? But there's many, many other carbon-based molecules, and organic chemistry includes all of that. And inorganic chemistry consists of non-carbon-based molecules. And so a lot of this involves things like metals and silicon and all sorts of things of that kind, which we need because, you know, if you look on the side of the cereal box, right, there's all sorts of metals on there. If you don't get enough iron, for example, you'll get anemia. And so we need these metals. And so my area of interest is why do we need those metals? What are they doing? How do they do what they do? What is the inorganic chemistry, that is the metals chemistry, involved in living things?
It's fascinating. But the iron probably gets linked onto a carbon chain at some point.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. We don't have a lot of just metals floating around inside of our bodies free, because that would be very bad. That would have a lot of toxic effects. Instead, these metals get attached to proteins as a rule, and those proteins essentially tune and control the reactivity of these metals in order to direct them down productive pathways so that they get used for what the cell needs them to do and not to create things like reactive oxygen species. I'll just briefly mention that reactive oxygen species are, as you might imagine, reactive chemicals that come from oxygen. And you've probably are familiar with antioxidants, which are very important components of our diet and so on. And the reason that they're important is because they help protect us from reactive oxygen species. So obviously, metals floating around and producing tons of extra reactive oxygen species is quite bad and needs to be avoided.
Do you study more of the disadvantages of metals in the body, or the advantages, or both?
Definitely much more on the advantages side. What I would say is that the inorganic chemistry of living things is in some ways the most essential part of what it means to be alive. And
whoa.
bold claims.
We're at the meaning of life here.
In the sense of in the purest physical sense. I'm not going to get involved in the more philosophical end of this.
We're at meaning of life here now.
That's the hook. But
great.
No.
Justify it.
In some sense, right, all things are engaged in a continual slide towards entropy.
Ooh, that's physics.
right? And so what it means to be alive is to harness favorable chemical reactions in order to maintain one's internal organization against the eternal slide towards entropy. And so in some sense, being alive is about harnessing chemical energy to keep that away.
You feel like it's about fighting the rise of this disorganization that we call entropy.
Right. In a sense, that is the natural state of things, is to slide towards disorganization.
Harnessing the increase in entropy, or I guess harnessing kind of a minimization of some free energy.
Right. We might be getting a little far afield here, you know, and I deliberately am minimizing the two components of what's called the Gibbs free energy. But maybe we'll just direct our attention elsewhere here.
Yeah, sure.
And
what does metal have to do with that?
Well, because essentially, in terms of how do we harness these favorable chemical reactions? Well, again, to greatly oversimplify, what it means to harness that energy is essentially to control the movement of protons and electrons in multi-proton, multi-electron chemical reactions. And in order to do that, essentially biology needs to use metals.
Because they can carry charge?
It's not that they are the only things that can carry charge, but they're the most efficient, particularly when it comes to moving single electrons. And so if you want to convert multi-electron processes to single electron processes, metals are very good at that.
Hmm. Wow. It sounds really important. Not that I know
I
what
think
the
so, but
single
I'm,
or
I'm
multi-
highly biased. Highly biased.
I don't know what a single or multi-electron process is, so it just sounds important. I don't know what's going on.
So, for example, oxygen, the air we breathe, the reason we need to breathe air is because the conversion of oxygen to two molecules of water, one molecule of oxygen to two molecules of water, it requires four electrons. And this is a tremendously favorable chemical reaction. But you might have noticed from the fact that the atmosphere is not on fire at all times that despite this being a very favorable reaction, it doesn't happen all the time. It needs some help to get going.
Okay, so favorable means it's likely to happen.
I would say favorable meaning there is a lot of chemical energy available from it happening.
Yeah, so I get energy when I'm breathing.
Right.
If I stop breathing, I'll become low energy.
Very low energy.
Okay. Got that.
Yep. So metals are essential to making those kinds of reactions happen.
Okay. Is it a catalyst or some other term?
Yes. Metals act as catalysts in these reactions, along with many other functions. Again, I'm vastly oversimplifying tremendously complicated processes.
Please do. Radio is not very conducive to drawing the pictures that are necessary to hold it all together in one brain space.
Yes, to say the least. The process of being alive involves many, many different things happening at the chemical level, many of which involve metals doing many different things. And putting electrons into oxygen is just one of them.
Yeah. Is any metal involved in putting the electrons into oxygen?
So in terms of that specific reaction, iron is the most essential.
Oh, component. No wonder iron is an essential thing to keep up on.
It is. Yes. Not to mention that without iron, the oxygen wouldn't get to the cells from your lungs in the first place because, of course, hemoglobin, which many folks, even who are not professional scientists, have probably heard of. Hemoglobin transports oxygen from our lungs to our cells, and the reason that our blood is red is from this protein, hemoglobin, and that red color comes from the iron that's bound in that protein.
Yeah, iron is very associated with a red color. Also, like, if you have soil that's reddish, it's probably from iron oxide.
I believe that's true.
So, what kinds of inquiries have you personally made? What studies have you done?
That's a big question, I guess. So, when I was in grad school, I had two primary projects that I was interested in. One project had to do with the reaction where, so you're undoubtedly familiar with DNA. DNA is, of course, very important, stores information about how to, the blueprints for cells, essentially. And the way that DNA stores this information is that DNA is a molecule that's a long chain of individual links, or as we call them in chemistry, we call them monomers. And those individual links in the chain are called deoxyribonucleotides. And together, once they're in a chain, they make deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. And so in order to make these deoxyribonucleotides, there's a reaction. They need to be reduced from ribonucleotides. So ribonucleotides get converted to deoxyribonucleotides, they make DNA. And so the protein that does this reaction, which all living things need, because all living things need to make DNA, is the reaction I was studying. And it's performed by a protein called ribonucleotide reductase. So ribonucleotides are the individual links in the long chains that are called RNA.
Yeah, I've heard of RNA.
Right.
Okay, so you link up all your ribonucleotides, they become RNA.
They become RNA. Now, RNA, you can actually transcribe into DNA.
It's funny, because usually it's the DNA making the RNA.
Well, yeah.
But you could go either way.
Right. So, when you use DNA as a pattern to make RNA, that's called transcription. When you use RNA to make DNA, that's called reverse transcription. It's less common, but the point is that there's a relationship here between RNA and DNA, but also on the individual units, the individual links in the chain, the ribonucleotides can be converted into deoxyribonucleotides.
And those are the individual links.
The individual links in the chain of DNA.
Well, it makes sense. If the big long one can make the other big long one, then the little short one can make the other little short one. You can make the
right
ribonucleotide from the deoxyribonucleotide, or
the difference is ribonucleotides to deoxyribonucleotides only goes one way.
Oh, okay.
You can't make deoxyribonucleotides into ribonucleotides.
It only goes from ribonucleotides to deoxyribonucleotides. Okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
That's so surprising because normally it's DNA to RNA.
Right, right.
So it's like backwards for the single monomers.
Yes, exactly. The source of all DNA is deoxyribonucleotides. Those are the links in the chain. And all of those links come from ribonucleotides. So this is the only way in, essentially.
Ribonucleotides become deoxyribonucleotides,
which become DNA,
which link together to become the DNA.
Right.
Which is really important. Oh, thank you. I learned something there.
So the thing is that when RNA and DNA go back and forth, that's not an individual molecule of DNA that's being converted into RNA. That's DNA being used as a pattern to make RNA.
Oh, but the DNA remains.
The DNA stays.
Right.
So that's the difference, is that if I'm going to make a molecule of DNA...
This is like it's actually converting.
Right. If I'm going to make a molecule of DNA, I need a bunch of molecules of deoxyribonucleotides, which are made from a bunch of molecules of ribonucleotides. I can then use that DNA as a pattern to make an RNA molecule, which is a long chain of ribonucleotides. But I need those ribonucleotides in terms of making that.
Nice. Is this part of the meaning of life? To make DNA?
It's part of the part of the big process. Yep. We got to make the DNA so that we can continue to stay alive.
If my purpose in life is to make DNA, I am killing it. This is great.
So I studied a particular ribonucleotide reductase from a particular organism that has some different properties from the one that, for example, human cells use. And because of those differences, it was of interest.
What organism?
Specifically, the organism was Chlamydia trachomatis.
Oh, I've heard of chlamydia.
Yes, yes.
I'm sorry. How do you grow chlamydia? So trachomatis.
So which may or may
not be the same as the one I've heard of.
So I never worked with the organism chlamydia, only with the gene for this one protein.
Oh, do you just buy it at the store?
Not at the store, but from a scientific supplier.
Yes, yes. Mail order, like all the specialty things.
Yes, exactly.
It's how everyone shops, you know.
Yeah, we buy it online.
I know.
We order the gene and then use the gene to produce the protein.
Oh, okay.
And then we study the protein.
What sort of metals are involved in all this?
So what's really interesting about this particular protein from chlamydia is that it's one of only a few examples of a protein that uses both iron and manganese together. So it has two metals, one right next to the other, and instead of two irons or two manganeses or something else like that, it has one of each.
What role do the iron and manganese have?
That's a great question. So essentially what the iron and manganese are doing is they are creating a potently reactive species which can start the reaction needed to convert ribonucleotides to deoxyribonucleotides. It's sort of like, you know, here in upstate New York, we get a lot of snow. And if you have a snowblower, you need to get the snowblower started. And so in order to get the snowblower started, you might have a pull chain and you pull on it a few times and you are putting a bunch of energy to get things going. But once things are going, then you don't have to put in very much effort. You're just sort of walking behind the snowblower, pushing it a little bit. And so it's similar in that with this chemical reaction, the initial part of the reaction takes a bunch of chemical energy, and so the metals are there to provide that initial burst of chemical energy to get things going in the reaction.
How do you observe that?
So there's a bunch of different ways that we can observe what's going on. One way is that we can detect ribonucleotides and deoxyribonucleotides because they have different weights. Now, those weights are incredibly small, but we have sophisticated scientific instrumentation that can differentiate those.
Wow. What do you use?
We use what's called a mass spectrometer.
Oh, sure.
We can go into that. It's a little bit.
Okay, we'll put that into a box and step to the side.
Another way that we can monitor what's going on in the reaction is that the reaction is actually associated with color changes, and so you can monitor the absorbance of visible light over time. Another way that in particular I did a lot of work in two different areas. One is to observe the magnetism of the single unpaired electron in this this metal center. For those of you who are not too familiar, to simplify things, electrons are essentially tiny little bar magnets. So that magnetism, we can study that and use that to basically get a look inside these proteins by taking advantage of those magnetic properties.
Do you use nuclear magnetic resonance or electron magnetic resonance?
Electron paramagnetic resonance.
Yeah, EPR.
Yeah, which is a very fun technique that is hard enough to explain even with visuals. I will not make the attempt over the radio.
Fair enough. I also do electron paramagnetic resonance.
Oh, that's fun.
And will also decline to attempt.
So I did quite a bit of electron paramagnetic resonance, or EPR. Another technique that I used quite extensively is X-ray spectroscopy. We would take our proteins to mile-wide underground particle accelerators and blast them with high-energy X-rays and see what comes out.
Wow. You can observe in all of these ways, from mass spectrometry, electron paramagnetic resonance, absorbance of light, and X-ray spectroscopy. You can observe a chemical reaction occurring, all thanks to the presence of the iron and manganese that gets it started.
Essentially, yes, yes. So my work was specifically concerned with what are the metals doing? How are they changing throughout the reaction? What is their structure, both their geometric structure and their electronic structure? And so using a lot of different techniques to understand what's going on with the metals that allow them to do this very difficult and interesting reaction.
Yeah, I'm sure if they're not in the right place at the right time, they don't help.
Presumably not. Presumably not.
You said there were two projects.
I did. So the second project involved a family of iron-dependent enzymes. And these enzymes, what's really interesting about this family is that there's a whole big group of these enzymes, and they all share a common overall structure. They share the same metal, and largely that metal is bound to the protein by the same protein amino acids. In fact, then the iron reacts with oxygen and makes the same iron 4 intermediate. And yet, this intermediate manages to react with, in different examples of this family, the iron manages to carry out a bunch of different types of chemical reactions. So we were really interested in how these enzymes, individual members of the family, direct the reactivity down only one of these available pathways. When seemingly any of these different things could happen, how does it control what happens?
The iron is like a multi-tool.
Right, right. And how is it that somehow the protein is involved in pulling out just one of those tools at a time? How does it control which tool is engaged? And what we were specifically interested in is the role of substrate positioning in that reaction control. So the substrate, this is just biochemist jargon for the thing that a chemical reaction is happening to. So a minute ago we were talking about ribonucleotides getting converted to deoxyribonucleotides by a protein. The ribonucleotides would be the substrate. So in this case there are other substrates, but that's neither here nor there. So anyway, the point is that the substrate, in order to undergo this chemical reaction, needs to get pretty close to the iron. It's in the same area, and this is something proteins are very good at. But what we wanted to know is specifically where around the iron is the substrate, is it really close? Is it only fairly close? And also some angular information that I won't go into again for radio-based reasons. And so we were actually using electron paramagnetic resonance to ascertain that sort of geometric information about where the substrate is, and using that to answer some questions about this reaction control, and also developing new methods to measure that substrate positioning.
Yeah, I can't imagine how you can measure the orientation, the positioning of these. They're so small. I mean, I know that people use all kinds of techniques like FRET to see how close things are at that scale, but it's complicated.
It's very complicated. But to simplify it a little bit, I mentioned earlier that electrons are essentially tiny little bar magnets. Mm. And many nuclei are essentially even tinier little bar magnets. And something you know, of course, is that when you get two magnets close to each other, you can feel them interacting through space because, you know, they want to flip and be anti-parallel in orientation.
Yeah, north to south and south to north.
North to south and south to north. And so the importance here is that magnetic things can feel each other through space. And essentially what we can do using electron paramagnetic resonance is measure those through-space interactions with nearby nuclei. And from that, we can extract information about where those nuclei are relative to the electron, which is on the iron.
As long as you don't have any unpaired electrons besides the iron.
That's right. But conveniently, most proteins do not have other unpaired electrons hanging around.
Wow. So the iron really is the magnetic object in there.
Yes.
And this is not the one that has the manganese, so you don't have to worry about its magnetic field
interfering.
Wow. One thing I noticed is that in both of these studies, iron played such a key role. When you talk about metals that I need to have in my diet, iron immediately comes to mind. And I feel like this is very justified by your research area.
I'm very biased in favor of iron. But I'm not a nutritionist, so I won't hazard to comment on the importance of iron relative to other things in one's diet.
There's metals I want to avoid.
Sure.
Like lead.
Lead, mercury are some prominent examples.
And then there's the metal I want to make sure I'm eating, which is iron.
Oh, iron, but also zinc is very important. Cobalt is actually very important, in particular a form of cobalt that's in vitamin B12, which is called cobalamin. This is especially important if you're a vegan, because this vitamin is only produced in animal tissue. So it's very, very important to have supplements that include cobalamin.
Are there supplements that synthesize it without using animal products for the vegans?
I think so. Again, this is a little out of my depth in terms of nutritional stuff. But yes, I think that you can synthesize the cobalamin probably from yeast sources or something like that.
Oh, that makes sense. Have you considered studying these other metals, or is that for your colleagues and you're still on iron?
I love iron, and that's definitely my primary area of interest, but I have studied some cobalt at one point in my postdoc.
And oh, where did I you like postdoc? Manganese.
Oh, I worked at Princeton University for a couple of years before I came to Hamilton, between my PhD at Penn State and here.
Was that fully a research-based postdoc?
Yes.
Oh, cool. What did you do there? Cobalt?
Well, so that was one thing that I was working on. It didn't go particularly well.
That happened.
but my main area of interest in that was discovering new chemical reactions that are performed by these metal-dependent enzymes, specifically in the production of so-called natural products. These include things like antibiotics that living things make for reasons other than just eating and reproducing. Killing your neighbors is only indirectly related to eating and reproducing. And so
This is an important part of the survival at the micro scale.
Right, right. And so one microbe might make an antibiotic to kill other microbes that are competing with it, and so on and so forth. And so this is really important because something like 60 to 70% of all FDA-approved drugs are natural products or derivatives of natural products in one form or another, whether that be directly altered natural products or synthetic chemicals that are inspired by natural products. But in general, many, many drugs are based on these natural product molecules.
Yeah, dating back to penicillin.
Yeah, all the way back to penicillin. And in fact, long before penicillin, there are these, a while back I was reading, there are these mummies that in their tooth, I think in their tooth enamel, they have tetracycline, which is an antibiotic, and...
Get out of here. They were taking antibiotics in
ancient Egypt? Well, so it's speculated that they were somehow the antibiotics were being produced by the microbes in the beer they were drinking. So it's not clear if this was a deliberate thing or just sort of some sort of happy side effect that, like, if the people who were drinking the beer didn't tend to get sick as often or something like that. Really fascinating, though. I mean, my impression is that not a lot is known other than that there seemed to be a lot of tetracycline floating around in order to get this much tetracycline in the teeth of these mummies.
That's interesting, because I was thinking beer, the original probiotic.
Right.
But also probiotic and antibiotic.
Right.
All at once.
Yeah.
You grow one thing, you don't grow the other things. Which is important.
Pretty fascinating. Pretty fascinating. This was just something I read about. I'm not an expert, but I did find it very fascinating.
I think it's cool.
So anyway, what my project was I was trying to discover new metalloenzyme reactions in the production of natural products such as antibiotics and other potential drug candidates.
Okay, so you're looking at something that could maybe be a drug, a potential drug candidate, and you're curious to see what the role of metals might be.
Well, so it's actually more like the other way around. We were trying to use the presence of metal-based proteins to discover new natural products, which might then be useful as drugs or drug candidates.
Is this something where metal can do a lot, and you know it can do a lot, so you're like, let's check out things with metal, and maybe the thing it does is a good thing.
Precisely. Because metals are such flexible tools and powerful tools, the idea of the study was sort of that if we look for natural products that are created using these metal-based proteins, that will sort of enrich our discoveries in interesting and novel molecules.
This does sound like some of the meaning of life. I think you meant the meaning of life at a microscopic, single-celled level. But drug discovery is something where we really are establishing that we can create a more comfortable and more healthy life for ourselves. It's incredibly important.
Incredibly important. And especially so in the area of antibiotic discovery, because the problem of antibiotic resistance is tremendously frightening and unfortunately might not involve making a more comfortable existence for ourselves so much as preventing a return to the time before antibiotics when infections were not so readily cured. And that's a pretty frightening potentiality.
You know, the failure of antibiotics is something that hasn't come up yet on this radio show, and it's such an important topic. Maybe you could explain more for people who might not have heard about it.
Sure. I'd love to. The essential idea here is that antibiotics, as a rule, kill bacteria. And so when you've got a whole bunch of bacteria in, let's say, an infection, and you add an antibiotic, and some number of those bacteria, because there are tons of them, those bacteria, billions and billions of bacteria, because they're so tiny. And they're all a little bit different from each other, just like all people are different from each other, right?
They do mostly reproduce just asexually by just cloning themselves. One cell becomes two daughter cells. They're supposed to be clones.
Right, but...
There's mutations.
Like in all things in life, mistakes get made. And right. So there's always slight variations, and so all the bacteria are slightly different from each other. And so in a population of billions of these bacteria in your gut, say, or, you know, something like that, and so you take an antibiotic, and this kills 99.9% of the bacteria, but that 0.01% have some variation that allows them to survive. And so then what happens is that those 0.01% grow and divide and reproduce, and all of their progeny have that same ability to evade whatever antibiotic killed the 99.9% initially.
The way you describe it sounds like it would happen almost every time you take an antibiotic. I assume that at those low levels, sometimes your immune system can kick in.
Yes, absolutely. So on an individual level, a lot of the time, you sort of knock back most of the bacteria with an antibiotic, your immune system is able to sort of clean up the rest. But the problem is that at a population level, on a global level, there are always that we've basically created all of these populations of bacteria that are resistant to the various antibiotics in our arsenal. And what's really unfortunate is that it's not just if I take an antibiotic and I get a resistant infection and then maybe I die. That would be unfortunate, right? But what's worse is that the bacteria are talking to each other, in a sense. They're swapping tactics. Not literally, but they're sharing the genes that allow them to evade these antibiotics. And as a result, the prevalence of these antibiotic-resistant infections is increasing, and it's vastly outpacing our ability to discover new antibiotics. And that's a very frightening thing. And so how this connects back is that part of the reason that we're having such a hard time finding new antibiotics is that when we go looking for new natural products, we keep discovering the same stuff we've already found. In a sense, the low-hanging fruit has been picked, and we need new ways to discover new natural products. And so an example of that is this sort of enzyme-first discovery approach that we were using. That's an example of a new way to look for natural products that's genetics-first, protein-first, rather than product first.
Wow. I mean, we're locked in this battle against the bacteria that can cause us to become sick.
Mm-hmm.
And the bacteria, their approach is just to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks, because they just have these random mutations, and probably most mutations are probably not so great for the bacteria.
Right.
But every now and then they found a mutation that one survives.
When you roll the dice a billion times, you're bound to get some hits.
Now, we're in a battle against that, but humans can't roll the dice a billion times.
Right.
We don't have that many scientists working on drug discovery. So it sounds like you're hoping that looking at metal-dependent enzymes might allow us to get the odds in our favor.
Well, what we need is a lot of different approaches. And so I'll be the first to say I'm far from an infectious disease expert, and I'm just...
You have your role to play.
Right. But we need to combat antibiotic resistance on many, many levels. So these levels can look like making sure that we're not taking antibiotics for viral infections, which is incredibly common. This can look like changing the role of antibiotics in our food systems. In particular, there's a lot of antibiotics that go towards livestock and they're used what's called prophylactically. They're just, they give the livestock antibiotics because that makes them grow faster, but they're not sick. But what happens is that then you're just pumping tons of antibiotics into these livestock, and that's just creating a million little test tubes for antibiotic resistance to arrive. And what's really scary is that then if anything develops in one of those, you know, test tubes in a cow, or not a literal test tube, but the metaphorical test tube of a cow, then that bacteria might swap that resistance gene with some sort of pathogen that can infect us. And that's pretty scary.
Yeah, we are certainly creating a situation that could really blow up on our faces giving antibiotics when not necessary.
Yeah, so we need to do what we can to prevent further accumulation of antibiotic resistance, find new antibiotics to work when we need antibiotics, and also to explore non-antibiotic methods of treatment of infections. So this can look like various ways to help our immune system fight infections on its own, or probiotic solutions. There are many, many strategies for fighting the fight against antibiotic resistance. But the reality is we need all of those, because this is arguably the greatest health challenge of the 21st century.
I can believe that. So we only have a few minutes left, Ryan. So I'm just curious, if there is a Hamilton College student who's interested in working in your research lab, what kinds of projects might they be working on?
Yeah, absolutely. So broadly speaking, the kinds of projects they would be working on are similar to some of the ones that we've been talking about in terms of understanding the role of metals, in particular, the role that metals play in constructing natural products. So for example, different enzymes that are involved in producing antibiotics or other complex molecules. We have some examples of projects in my lab right now where we know that this is a natural product that gets made. We know that there are some genes involved, but we're not sure the order of steps and what happens when. And so one of the projects in my lab is involved in trying to figure out, okay, we've got this metalloenzyme, this iron-dependent enzyme. Which step is it involved in? Is it step two, step three? What is step three? What's happening on a chemical level that involves these metal-dependent enzymes that are ultimately making these natural products?
Will your students be working with the chlamydia?
No.
It's an important question.
Yeah, critical.
What organism are you planning to use?
So most of the work that I do is done in E. coli. So even if we're working with a gene from Xanthomonas or some other organism, we can take the genes for the individual proteins we're interested in, insert them into E. coli, and use E. coli to manufacture the proteins that we're interested in.
Use E. coli because it's so easy to grow, right?
Exactly.
It just kind of grows on its own.
Yep. Yeah, it's very, very simple. You know, even chemists can figure it out.
Oh, man. Okay, Ryan Martini, thank you so much for coming on Significant Figures. This is WHCL-FM, Clinton, New York. I'm Viva Horowitz. I'm the host of Significant Figures.